Everyone is talking about the future of work, Doing Our Homework, a podcast produced by USM.
Hi, my name is Uta Schwarz, and I am currently in the countryside near Berlin at the USM Workhouse. Why this should be important to you? Because in the next weeks, this place will be a laboratory for the future of work. In the next 20 minutes, we will meet the CEO of global think tank Fast Future, a coach and consultant of WorkHacks, and a philosopher who had breakfast with Socrates. All three of them will shed light on different aspects of our future work lives. Let's find out what they have to say. We want to welcome our first guest, Rohit Talwar. You just told me how your name is pronounced.
It's Rohit.
Rohit. I'm sorry for that. Right. And right now we are sitting in the main house at Wehrmühle, a former mill. Rohit is CEO of Fast Future and therefore the right person to answer our questions about the future of work. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Our first question is kind of really, how are we working and living in the next decades? What do you imagine?
So that's a very broad question. If you imagine that there are 7.5 billion people on the planet and everyone has a different view about how their future might play out and what work means to them. But I think if we take a very Western perspective and the kind of people who are gathered here, what's clear is that technology is going to play a bigger role in our work. Uncertainty about what the future holds will play a bigger role, which might make people more focused on the short term. I think creativity will become much more important because as the technology takes more and more of the routine parts of our work, then we have to focus on creative problem solving around that, creating new products and services, creating new relationships with customers, and also looking at the new industries and businesses that are emerging. And how do we create a relationship with them? So creativity becomes critical to the future of work, certainly in the Western world.
So how would you describe the different types of future that you see?
So on the one hand, we have people taking quite a negative view of the future, saying we're becoming more intolerant as a world, we're becoming more nationalistic, machines are taking people's jobs, and as individuals, we're becoming a little less tolerant and a little less open. So that's the sort of dystopian view that ultimately the machines will do most of the work. The people who build the machines and program them and the investors will take all the money and the rest of us will be scrabbling around in a very unpleasant future. Then there's another view that says, no, actually, we might change the whole way we look at our lives and what work is for. So there's a range of science and technologies coming that could give us abundance. You know, the internet gives us free distribution. Vertical farming could give us virtually free food. Synthetic biology could create all sorts of new miracle materials that clean up our planet. And artificial intelligence might free us up to do higher level things, to be more creative, to be more imaginative. So we could have a very bright future where we're doing the work we want to be doing. We have a better balance between what we would consider work and private life. And we're more connected as a community because there are less things to fight over. And money is distributed in different ways. That's the kind of ultimate, more positive scenario. How it will play out will probably be different in every part of the world, and I think we'll probably see those two ends of the spectrum. But a lot of us will be in the middle where we're doing okay. We're not necessarily all becoming multimillionaires, but that might not be our goal. But equally, societal happiness may well have been raised up a few levels across most of the planet.
I really like the last version of being more happy and more creative. Could you tell us maybe if you see like three really concrete things which we can sense right now, which are foreboding the future?
So one is we're starting to see artificial intelligence really emerge into all sorts of things. You're seeing companies reducing their workforce because they're automating processes. You're seeing robots coming in. But you're also seeing incredible new ideas made possible, like diagnosing cancer in ways we'd never thought possible, coming up with better ways of managing the flow of money in the economy, dealing with problems like waste in the food chain. So we're seeing some very powerful applications, one, through AI. Secondly, we're seeing people wanting more control over how their destiny plays out, being much more interested in their own purpose and making a difference with whatever they do. So they're asking for more of their employers, they're asking for more of themselves, and they're constantly looking for opportunities to create now. We see more of that, people starting their own businesses. And the third one is that we're breaking the stranglehold of money on the exchange of goods and services. Now money's become digital. It means that anything can be traded and for value. So you might paint my house and get credits from me, which you can then exchange for food in the local store. You can trade your air miles or your store loyalty points to buy food in the local store. We're moving to the potential for us to have ecosystems where not only money allows you to access value. So you might need to buy things for your business. You don't have the money to pay for it. So instead, you go and work, you know, literally you could go and work in a local food store to earn some credits that are then used to pay for the goods you want. We're moving into a much more interesting world that actually might look a bit more like how people lived in tribal times
or in early times. It's because it's a trade now.
But these things might be facilitated by very big players. You know, we might be doing all this inside an ecosystem created by Amazon, Facebook or Google or Baidu. But we're moving to a world where money might have less importance than it does today in terms of us being able to access what we want.
How would that affect the role of women in the future?
On the one side, we see some very positive things happening where women are standing up and saying enough. You know, we want equal pay. We want equal access to opportunity. You know, if not now, then why not? You know, rather than if not now, then when? But on the other hand, we see there are some issues that things are actually moving backwards for women at a global scale. So last year, in 2017, the World Economic Forum estimated that for women across the globe to reach parity with men on job opportunities and salaries would take 170 years. Oof. Now, the latest figures, that's got worse. They now say it will take 217 years.
Okay, not in our lifetime.
So not in your lifetime, possibly not in your children's lifetime, and possibly not in their lifetime. What needs to happen is for us to really break the mold now, for people to start being very brave in organizations and saying, even if the law doesn't require it, we are going to set standards that mean you have to prove why you're not bringing as many women into jobs as men. Not a quota, but you just have to prove why it was that you didn't find women who are as good. And positively reaching out to give opportunity to women in organizations and training to help them navigate increasingly masculine organizations. And finally, to give real support to women who want to start their own businesses so that they're not bound by traditional male hierarchies. They can do their own thing and create what they want.
I really like the idea of an army of female entrepreneurs. One of them is Lydia Schildgen. I'll meet her outside. We're here with Lydia Schildgen, consultant and coach, at the ping pong table. Because we're not only working here at the Wehrmühle, but we also, there's a number of creative workshops going on, like creating a ping pong racket out of a piece of paper. So we're going to see how that really works later. One of these creative people here is Lydia Schildgen, consultant and coach, about the topic of work. Hello.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi. So you wrote a book with a great title, Work Hacks, 6 Attacks on Stuck Work Processes. So we all know life hacks, right? These are little tricks on how to peel an avocado or get a nail out of the wall. So what is a work hack then?
Yeah, a work hack, some people think that it's just for individuals to make their work more efficient, but work hacks attack more team dynamics. So the idea behind that is that many teams, team dynamics are not really enabling teams to make the best results, but some team dynamics are really bad for the psychology safety. And psychology safety is one of the biggest influencers for good results.
Can you give maybe an example of one of these work hacks?
Yeah. For instance, for psychological safety, we found something that is called retrospective. That's one method in Scrum. And we took it out of the methodology and said, okay, this is pretty easy to use even with not having Scrum in total.
So how does it work?
So retrospective is pretty easy. It has three questions. What works well together? What doesn't work well together? Or what do we do together? What doesn't work well? And what should we try out? So keep, drop and try are the most important questions in this meeting. And it takes part every second week, bi-weekly.
Okay, and another bestseller in your work hack toolbox is focus time, I heard.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you mean by that? How does that work?
Yeah, it's our really bestseller, and I love it. It's just an hour per day where nobody talks, where no meetings take part, and where no telephone rings. So it's absolutely silence, and the idea behind that is if you want to go into deep work, you need 15 to 18 minutes. And if somebody interrupts you and asks, hey, how was the meeting last week? And you answer to that question, you lose minimum 15 to 18 minutes. So most people are really frustrated with not really finishing work, and so they get an hour per day, and it's really going well.
So the idea is just to focus on one task at a time. No multitasking anymore.
Yeah, no multitasking and no interruption. Yeah, and the smart people, they ask themselves, okay, what do I need to do to finish today? And they put this task into their focus time, and then they finish it then. And then they're really happy about that too. Mm. So it's also, it has a psychological impact.
Yeah, we really want to be happy at work. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. So I, for example, said I'm not going to have any emails. I'm not going to send any emails today. How can I introduce that idea to my colleagues or even the boss? He might not be too happy about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Normally, people go out of my seminars or my talks and say, oh, I love the focus time. I just going to introduce it to my team and then we will do that. And I said, stop, don't do that. Because the work hack is the one thing and the other thing is how to introduce that to a team. And we really talked about a lot of resistance in change programs. And we came to the idea that people need to distinguish between one or the other method. So if you're going to present something to your team, please present some ideas and let the team distinguish if they want to do something like that and which one they want to have. And if they do that, you have a better chance that it sticks.
Okay, so coming back to the idea of the ping pong racket made of paper, so what do you think people need to be creative or to be motivated to work?
I think they need a little time for that. That's why we have, for instance, the work hack Slack time, where you have as a team a day per month where you do your own project. You just let loose everything else, the daily work, and you focus on something you really want to do. Gmail was invented with this work hack, and I strongly advise that to companies who need ideas and innovations. So we have some space here at Biesenthal, and I think we have the material and we have the creative people, so just let's sort it out.
Let's try it out.
Let's try it
for example with a paper racket. So let's see if it really works.
Yeah, let's see.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The main problem with free association.
Who we are hearing here in the background, that's Robert Roland Smith, a philosopher, and he's giving a keynote, and we're sneaking out right now because we are having him as a guest next in our little studio. Robert Roland Smith is a British author and philosopher who wrote several books, Breakfast with Socrates and Driving with Plato. I like the titles of those. They're about milestones, life's milestones, the one, and the other is about meaning of life. So broad and really big questions. that is good, because we have brought in big questions for you too. Because what we were wondering is kind of like, if a sofa is still a sofa when you're working on it. So what do you think?
Well, a sofa is a good object to choose because a sofa began its life in the home and then has migrated, first of all, into the TV studio and then into the workspace. So the movement of the sofa during the 20th and 21st century tells us a story about how the idea of home has been brought out of the home and into other spaces, because there's no more homely item than the sofa other than the bed. But I think we've got a long way to go before you find a bed in a TV studio or indeed in the workplace.
The school of my son, they have a kind of like a bed space in the school. I was always wondering why that is.
I think for young children, it's a bit different.
Yeah. So, but we don't have that at workplaces, that's true. But what do you think? So it's the purpose of things. Do they have only one? No, obviously not. So how do we change things? You said the sofa was kind of like making this journey. So,
yeah, so the sofa is multi-purpose, multifunctional. And of course, you know, the smartphone is the epitome of a multifunctional device. But for me, the sofa is actually a very interesting question, because it forces us to think about how much we should relax at work. You talked about chilling out at work. Well, if you take an old-fashioned definition of work, work is actually the opposite of relaxing.
True.
Right. So how far should we go in relaxing at work? Are we still working if we are relaxing? Now, if you go into the offices of, say, Google or very contemporary digital companies, you'll find actually lots of spaces where people, quotes unquote, relax. And the purpose of that is not actually to allow people to relax. It's to create conditions for them to be able to think.
Yeah.
Because creativity is supposed to be facilitated by relaxing of the body, which in fact is a principle that comes to us from psychoanalysis. You lie on the couch, the sofa.
That's true.
In order for the unconscious to become liberated for free association. So the idea actually has deep links with psychoanalysis. The question, I think, in the modern workplace is whether the creativity is really being produced or not through the efforts of relaxation. So the most obvious example would be the brainstorm.
Mm-hmm.
So in a brainstorm in an office, and I've been in several of them.
Yeah, me too.
Right. In my experience, most of them are dreadful.
They are.
So why is that? Because, okay, people sit on sofas, they have their cappuccino or soy latte, and they're asked to brainstorm and come up with new ideas. But if you sit in a brainstorm today, what will almost inevitably happen is that certain words will be repeated. So artificial intelligence, somebody will say digital, somebody will say viral, somebody will say neuro.
Bullshit bingo then.
Right, exactly. Somebody will say Facebook, somebody will say Google, etc., etc. So although brainstorming on the sofa is supposed to be about creation, it's more about recreation, recreating the zeitgeist. It's not the new, it's the present just being recycled within the room. So you can ask, you know, is the sofa really performing its function there, or is it really putting people to sleep?
Okay, what I was wondering is, because, okay, the sofa's journey is in the office, so where's the home and all that? So is it kind of like lost? Is the sofa lost for real relaxation and the home kind of environment?
So we have to ask ourselves then, what do we mean by home? And home is as much a state of being as it is a physical place, because you can feel at home in places you've never been before. How do you create that in a work environment? And should you create that in a work environment? Do you want people to be at home? Well, if you're running a factory, you probably don't want your staff to be too much at home.
That's true.
You want them to be productive and efficient and working hard and alert and conscious and so on.
Mm.
And it's an interesting question, I think. Where really is the home within a workspace?
The warm place for the heart. Okay.
And I think traditionally the heart of a company was the boardroom, but it's not a space of the heart. It's a space of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think it became, particularly with modernist design, it became the atrium, you know, the entranceway with the tall ceiling and the light and the plants and the receptionists
so
on. But the question there is whether that home is really a home or not, because actually it's just a place of passage, people coming in and going out. So it's not really, if you think about the hearth of a home, it's where people don't come and go.
No,
it's where they rest,
yeah.
Where they settle. So where in an office do you really settle? And I think for most people, it's become their desk. They make their desk into a mini home and they That's decorate true, it like
pictures,
a shrine.
Yeah.
Pictures of their kids, soft toys, little souvenirs from trips that they've
That's
gone
true,
on,
yeah.
or, you know, a spare pair of comfortable shoes under the desk. So they're recreating home. But then you get many different homes, those cubicles, each become kind of separate homes away from home.
Yeah.
Whether the office as a whole is a home is, I think, an open question. I don't think offices are homely.
We have just heard three different views on creativity. What do you think? What makes us creative? Is it free time? Is it having no interruption, as Lydia suggested? According to Robert, it is obviously not a comfy sofa. What do you need in order to be creative? Colleagues maybe, or a business partner? We will talk about that next time. I'm Uta Schwarz. Thanks for listening.
Doing Our Homework, a podcast about the future of work. For more information, please visit our website, homework.usm.com.